Thursday, May 18th. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Coming up a little later, we're going to look at teen marijuana use. Delaware just legalized recreational adult use of marijuana following New Jersey 2 years ago. There's just more weed around, and it looks like young people are increasing their use, so we want to talk about it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about how teens are using marijuana and also discuss how it might be affecting their still developing brains. If you are a parent or have young people in your life, how do you talk to your kids about cannabis? Are you worried about it? The number to call is 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org.
Also, it's Studio 2 Trivia Thursday. Avi, are you excited? You get all excited.
I haven't heard
Thursday.
That particular inflection before. Hey. I like that.
Try something new. So I wonder what question Avi has dug up for our contestants. I'm excited. But first, we got to do our jobs a little bit, get to some stories that caught our eye. Avi, what caught your eye today?
Well, I learned today that tweeting is good for your mental health.
Okay.
Not the tweeting that we do all the time online.
A different
type of tweeting. Yes, that type of tweeting. The tweeting that comes from birds.
Ooh.
According to something that we caught this morning in the Washington Post, there's a lot of scientific evidence that the sounds of birds chirping and indeed the sight of birds around you can boost your mental health. Do you buy it?
I buy it a little bit. Yeah. You know, I go on long walks, you know, a couple times a week. And I will say when I hear a little chirp, chirp, I feel a little bit better about my life, feel a little bit more grounded. You know, yeah, I like a little chirp every once in a while.
So apparently it can lessen feelings of depression, anxiety, or paranoia, according to a pair of recent studies in scientific reports.
Mm.
I have a tree outside my window where I sleep, and I often wake up to the sounds of birds chirping. And sometimes it can be a little annoying just because it's the first thing you hear when you wake up. I'm going to have a different attitude about it going forward. It's good for me. Thank you, birds, for waking me up.
Yeah, and according to the article, it's also good for the birds, too. You know, so there you go.
Of course, yes.
A little back and forth there for you. And since we're all relaxed now, thanks to the little chirp chirp or the birdie, we're going to talk taxes.
Right.
Did your back just tense up a little bit right there?
Prepared for that conversation now, yes.
New Jersey tax revenue is below expectations, and folks are criticizing Governor Murphy for big spending. The New Jersey Treasury Department says it now expects to collect $1.2 billion less for the fiscal year that ends June 30th than it estimated in February. And its forecast for the next fiscal year is now $1 billion lower than original estimates. This reversal was driven by a whopping $1.4 billion decline in gross income tax revenues. Now, these updated revenue projections will not force state leaders to make budget cuts this year, thanks to a record surplus of more than $7 billion, as well as an additional $2.5 billion that's currently set aside to pay down debt. But in the long run, this could force lawmakers, obviously, to take a look at how they're spending their money.
And my understanding, and I'm no expert, but my understanding is that decline that you mentioned in gross income tax collections is driven by the fact that the stock market is not doing as well. And so some of the taxes generated on earnings in the stock market are not what they once were.
And some people are also looking at whether or not some corporate tax cuts and other things have also impacted. And I should mention that nationally, the federal government is also pulling in less tax revenue than expected. Receipts are down 35% compared to what the U.S. received last year. And again, same reasons you mentioned, financial gain tax, not as much as predicted. Corporate tax receipts are down. And some people also think it could be because of tax credits given the folks in disaster areas like California. All of that could be contributing factors, but we don't really know.
So let's bring it back across the Delaware River, all the way over to the Schuylkill River now, where there's going to be a big regatta this weekend, the annual Stotesbury Cup Regatta, which is like the biggest scholastic rowing event in the whole country, happens every year here in Philadelphia. What it means for you, well, if you're rowing, welcome to Philadelphia. Glad to have you here.
Good luck
this weekend. If you're driving, it means Kelly Drive, by the way, is now closed today through Saturday because have you ever been to one of these regattas? There's a lot of moving equipment and boats and launches and trailers, hauling boats. A lot of things need to be closed down to make stuff like this happen. Mm-hmm. But it's a great tradition, 96th annual Stotesbury Cup Regatta.
Yeah, I think I covered it once in my years as a reporter.
You do enough stories, you're yeah, like, I think I covered that
I think
that
I
once.
Covered that, you know, on a weekend. But again, Kelly Drive will be closed to traffic in both directions starting at 10 a.m. today, and it goes until 8 p.m. Saturday. So be mindful of that. And Avi, like everybody in our little area for Studio 2, we always look at your lunch because you always have like
my lunches.
Yeah, man. Avi brings in like these really delicious looking lunches and I'm eating like boring things. And he has
this great
lunch. I
think that's more commentary on what you guys eat than what
yeah,
I
eat. Yeah, we eat boring stuff. So anyway, I have this. I wanted to talk to you about Burger for Your Benjamins and see if what you think about this.
Okay,
I'm going to lay it
sure.
out. It's a bougie brioche burger. It is coming to Center City. Picture right. this. 8 ounces of Japanese ribeye wagyu, Irish cheddar cheese, Italian black truffle, Italian caviar, and lobster meat. We get this. Cognac.
Okay.
How much do you think it costs?
More than I'm going to spend.
$700.
This is a burger I can buy in Philadelphia?
Yeah, in Philly, yes. And then it's not just for the burger, though. It comes with a 1 ounce pour of Louis XIII cognac that costs about $5,000 a bottle.
Where can I go not buy this particular
yeah.
burger?
You got to wait till Friday, though.
Oh, Friday.
Yeah.
Where is it available?
You could only get it at DBG. It's known as the Drury Beer Garden in Center City. It'll reopen on Friday. $700. I should mention that it also has a gold leaf top on the top. It's edible. So
I'm going to stick with my lunches, Cherry, frankly. Okay. Sounds like a tremendous waste of money. $700 for a hamburger?
Yeah, it didn't look that great to me, but I'm not.
I don't even think
but some
those
people
things
like
go
that
together.
Rich.
Was it lobster meat?
Lobster meat
ribeye?
With cognac.
I wouldn't pay.
They put the yak in
it. I don't know if I'd eat that for free. I'm sorry, DBG. If you want to convince me otherwise, please give me a free version of this burger.
Yeah, send it to them for lunch.
And I'll try it, and I'll try to judge whether it's worth $700. My
they
gut tells me no.
Man.
My gut tells me no. But, you know, perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps I've misjudged the lobster caviar cheddar burger.
Yeah, Irish cheddar, okay?
Irish cheddar. That's I do like Irish cheddar.
International. So let's get to our newsmaker for today. In the last couple of years, the city has rolled out some funding for Philly violence prevention groups and really for the smaller grassroots groups on the ground that have been working to try to reduce shootings. We want to take a look at one program today that has caused a lot of turmoil within some of these groups, and it's led to anger towards the city of Philadelphia, and it's leaving people to question whether or not the program worked.
Some organizers say the city didn't help them manage the large sums of money they received through a pilot program. The city, no surprise, disagrees. Mm-hmm. So joining us now to talk about all of this is WHYY News gun violence prevention reporter Sammy Kayola. Sammy, welcome to Studio 2. So glad to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Cherry, start us off. So let's set the stage.
Yeah. Now, it's called the Community Expansion Grant Program, and it allotted a multi-million dollar sum between 31 groups. Explain the setup. Who got it and how it worked?
Yeah, so all told, it's about $13.5 million that was distributed, as you said, between 31 groups. And the city tried to be pretty careful about this selection process. They wanted violence groups that had been in existence for more than 3 years, and they wanted them to have annual operating budgets of under $15 million. So they wanted established groups, but groups that definitely were in need of financial assistance. And, you know, they said that their selection process was pretty robust, that they brought in, experts in philanthropy and nonprofits, that they brought in somebody called the Chief Integrity Officer. Mm. I learned that the city has that. They wanted to enable folks that have been doing this work for a very long time in their own neighborhoods to be able to do it in a bigger way to be able to reach more kids if they're serving kids, more formerly incarcerated people if that's who they're helping, just be able to take the work they're doing and do it on a larger scale.
So it's almost like seed money for groups that are established but a little smaller to help them sort of grow what they're doing.
Yeah, help you get to the next level.
Right.
Now, what happened was, and what I'm about to cite comes from a Philadelphia Inquirer analysis of this program with an investigation that they published recently. They found that a third of the groups were given grants that were actually larger than their operating budgets. And, you know, I've talked to experts about that being a pretty tough thing to just give a group that much money if they don't necessarily have a lot of staff or a lot of infrastructure. So these groups got to propose programs, you know, things that they wanted to create or expand. But then, you know,
they got a lot of money really quickly.
Yeah. And they didn't have, and talk about what this means. So they didn't have, a lot of them didn't have structure like a board because they were on the ground doing the work using a lot of times their own money.
Yeah, they were doing a lot of this out of their own pockets, kind of mom and pop shops, didn't have maybe all the staff that they would need. And I want to be clear, like a lot of these groups, it seems, did roll out their programs, did expand their services. I talked to Amir Healing Center. They hired a bunch more counselors to provide therapy to people who have lost people to gun violence. So a lot of them were doing the work. 28 of these groups reached some form of completion, according to the state. So 28 of 31.
That's pretty good, right?
Yeah, that is good. And 20 of the groups did ask for extensions. Mm. So they didn't get to spend out all the money. So they've asked for extensions into June. So the reality is, like, this isn't over. It's not over. We can't really say, did they do a good job or not? Because they're still using the money. The other thing here is that a lot of council members and community activists wanted to see an evaluation of how the money was spent. And the city said from the get-go, we're going to do that. Yeah. So they hired these four analysis groups to do an evaluation. It just hasn't been published yet.
And I got to ask you, because community groups have been very upset about some of the coverage of this. Can you talk about what was their concern here? And have we at WHYY done anything on that part?
Yeah. So when this Inquirer investigation came out showing how some of the groups didn't complete their programs or struggled to use the funds, you know, many Black-led nonprofits got together. They held a press conference and they said, hey, we think this is an unfair portrayal. We think this is harmful. It makes us seem incompetent, and it will make it harder for the government to trust us and fund us in the future. And you know, it's this delicate balance, right? Because people are calling for accountability. We need to know how the money is spent. But we also, you know, groups say we do need to trust them and we do need to help them get to where they need to be. If they're struggling, what support do they need? Do they need extra staff? Do they need some kind of liaison? Do they need more information? One of the big problems I heard about was the reimbursement, like having to file invoices for spending. That was really tough.
Because they had to spend their own money first before they could get any money. Yeah.
Yeah. So they got 20% of the money up front. And then after that, reimbursement was, there was a reimbursement process that was required. And, you know, if you're busy helping people on a day-to-day basis, hands-on work, filling out a bunch of reimbursement paperwork might be the first thing.
Back office is going to be tough if you're out there doing the work every day in the neighborhood. Can I ask you, it does seem, though, there's a natural tension between evaluation and expediency. Does it make sense to get this money to the community groups quickly, even if it isn't all spent perfectly, or is it better to vet the groups more, measure them more, even if it slows down the process? Because underlying all this, there's people's lives at stake when we're talking about anti-violence work. I mean, is one of these approaches better than the other?
Yeah, thank you for calling that out, Avi. I mean, this is urgent, right? And that's what a lot of the groups are saying, is like, just give us the funding. You know, we'll use as much of it as we can. And I think you can do both, right? I think in an ideal world, you can give groups upfront support, you can say, hey, do this program, let us know what you need. And at the same time, you can be tracking how they do it. And I did talk to one of the researchers that's involved with that public evaluation. She said, it's doable, but we just have to help them out.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Sammy.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, there is another round. We'll see what happens with that other funding. Sammy Cayola is a gun violence prevention reporter here at WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Last month, Delaware legalized recreational marijuana. And in New Jersey, it's been over a year since the first stores opened their doors. Now, 22 states have done it so far, for adults, of course. But more young people are getting their hands on it, too. There is an increase in teen marijuana use, which is worrying some researchers and some parents.
And we should note, this is not the same pot that people smoked even a decade ago. THC levels are often way higher. Researchers are concerned that this could stunt brain development. So we wanted to figure out how much we actually know so far and share some advice on talking to kids about cannabis in this new legalized world. So joining us is Danielle Dick. She is the director of the Rutgers University Addiction Research Center. Danielle Dick, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And you can call us with your questions or comments about teens and marijuana. Are you worried about it? Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. So, Danielle, we're going to dig right in. 38 states have legalized medical pot use. 23 states, including D.C., have legalized recreational marijuana. And more could be added to that list. So let's lay a foundation. What do we know about teen use of marijuana in states where pot is legal?
Well, one of the things we certainly know is that marijuana use is on the rise, and that is true among teens as well. And one of the things that is unambiguous in the research is that anything that increases access to a drug and acceptance of a drug increases use among teens and increases the likelihood that kids that are at risk will develop problems. And that's why many researchers like myself are concerned about the changing climate surrounding cannabis.
Can you put some numbers on that, Danielle? What does the data say about teen use and marijuana compared to prior generations?
Yeah, so there's a study, it's called Monitoring the Future, and it's been going on for several decades. And what they do is they essentially look at rates of drug use in 8th graders, 10th graders, and 12th graders to sort of track how things are changing across time. And what we've seen is a steady increase in both past year marijuana use, so kids who are trying it, and the thing that we are most concerned about, which is daily marijuana use. So this used to be far more rare. You would maybe have 1%, 3% of kids who reported daily use. Now we see that about in 2020, so this is data that's a few years old now, 7% of high school seniors were reporting using marijuana daily. And in our studies with college students, we find that that's up to about 10% of kids who are reporting daily cannabis use. And that's where we really get concerned.
Yeah. And Danielle, when we say marijuana, I'm thinking about the little joints that many of us Gen Xers or older millennials smoked back in college. But today's weed, isn't the weed of 20 years ago. When we talk about marijuana, explain exactly what we are talking about in today's terms.
That's such an important point, and it's one of the things that I find parents are often very confused or don't fully understand or appreciate, which is that this is a very different drug. In fact, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to parents and they'll say, well, I don't know what the big deal is. You know, I smoked a little grass back in the day. And I'll say, well, back then it basically was like smoking grass, meaning that it wasn't a very potent drug. So THC levels, and THC is what gives marijuana its psychoactive properties. It's the active ingredient. And the levels were about 3% in the 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way up through the early 2000s. And then what we see is as states begin to legalize marijuana and breeders have the ability to experiment with different plants, that the potency of marijuana gets stronger and stronger. And so it went from 3% to now it is on average 25%. And in edibles, which of course many kids are attracted to, the THC levels are 80 to 90%.
Okay, Danielle, I'm going to posit a theory and you're going to tell me why I'm stupid. So I'm trying to imagine a world where, because marijuana use is less taboo and increasingly accepted, more teens are comfortable saying in a survey that they use pot, whereas before, even if the survey was anonymous, they might have been reticent to share the truth because marijuana was so in the shadows. Is there any possibility that these rising numbers are really more about teens being willing to admit that they use marijuana?
Of course, that's always a possibility, but what we found is that these survey rates track with a number of other things that we see. And so, for example, we see far more kids showing up in the ER now with cannabis-induced psychosis or vomiting. So there's a number of other pieces of data that suggest that rates of regular use of cannabis are on the rise in kids. And the reason that we are most concerned about regular use of cannabis, daily use of cannabis, is because it's at that level that we start to see pretty profound, or the research is starting to suggest pretty profound effects on memory and motivation, which are, of course, key things that kids need as they are going through this phase of their life to do well in school, get jobs, do well in college, accomplish and achieve their goals. And that's why we're concerned.
Yeah, and we're going to dig into some of the impact in a moment. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Danielle Dick, director of Rutgers University's Addiction Research Center. We're talking about teen and young people's use of marijuana or cannabis. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. Tell us what your concerns are. We do have a caller on the line, Kevin, who has some concerns. Kevin, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks so much. Yeah, no, I worked in the Obama administration on these issues, and I want to just commend Dr. Dick for getting the truth out there, because there's a massive, you know, movement and industry whose business it is to addict our kids that make money off of all the misinformation about the so-called harmlessness. And this industry is pushing advertising, commercialization. They're funded often by big tobacco, these edibles, these candies, these attractive products. And so, as Dr. Dick is mentioning, that's why not only the THC levels that are higher now, it's the actual consumption numbers among sort of even occasional users. So 20 years ago, the average occasional user, 10% of them were using every day, which tracks with alcohol, by the way. About 10% of people who drank in the last month actually drank every day, 1 in 10. Now it's about 50% for marijuana for kids, and it's still around 10% for alcohol. So there's just been this dramatic shift, and it's fueled, I hope we can get into a little bit, the commercialization, the advertising, the lobbying, all of the relentless efforts that are not only by the kind of old, you know, protesters, hey, you know, free the weed, but are actually from guys from Wall Street who are investing in
it. So let's get into that, Danielle. Thanks so much for that comment. What is industry's role in driving perhaps misperceptions about marijuana's potency and, I suppose, its habit-forming qualities?
So thank you so much to Kevin for raising those issues. He is absolutely right that the legalization movement and the the essentially the laws surrounding cannabis availability are being driven not by research, not by scientists, but by commercialization and companies. And in fact, there is a great organization called Smart Approaches About Marijuana, which talks a lot about what's really going on with these policies and the parallels, candidly, to big tobacco in how when there is a new drug and there are not a lot of laws and regulations surrounding it, how much easier it is to push out misperceptions about the use of that drug and how that can essentially lead to many individuals becoming addicted to it. A lot of people think marijuana or cannabis is not addictive, and that is not the case. And these are some of the reasons that we are so concerned about the effects it's going to have, in particular on kids.
And so let's dig into what marijuana does to the brain here, because I think a lot of people don't know. I've covered legalization of marijuana in New Jersey years ago, and a lot of this talk was it's not addictive. It's relatively harmless, less harmful than alcohol. So talk about what does marijuana do to an actual brain, especially a developing brain of a young person.
So one of the frightening things is that we don't have great data on that. And that is because marijuana has been classified as a Schedule I drug. And so that means that in order to do research on it, it is very hard to get access to the drug. It's highly controlled. So it's in the same class with, for example, heroin. And so it means that researchers can only obtain the drug in certain quantities from places that are regulated and essentially administered by the US government. Of course, what that means is that the drugs that we can do research with are not the high potency drugs that people have access to when they, walk down to their corner shop. And this is because the legalization has happened so much faster than our ability to do research on it and to change the laws surrounding researchers' ability to actually study it. And so I just want to mention that first is that we don't have great data. And from what the messages that are getting out about legalization are suggesting, oh, it's safe. And that is certainly, from what we do know, not the case. There is no evidence to support that it is safe. And that is why it's being legalized.
So what is the hypothesis for how then it affects a developing brain? Even if we don't have complete data, scientists, I imagine, have an idea.
Absolutely. So we've started studying how it affects brain structure and function. And what the early data are suggesting is, as we would expect, there's a dose response. And so this gets to the fact that we're most concerned among, in particular, developing brains that are regularly exposed to the drug, i.e. like daily use of marijuana. And what we're finding, and what we also see clinically, is that individuals who are using daily, there start to be profound effects on the brain structures involved in memory and motivation. And that is particularly problematic in kids, because if you think about what they need to be doing, and in college students as well, they need to get themselves to classes, they need to study for their exams. In other words, they need memory and they need motivation to do well. And so it was actually on college campuses that my colleagues who were involved in our clinical settings started to say to me several years ago, we're really concerned about these rising rates of cannabis, because unlike when an individual is drinking regularly, and it starts to, when you start drinking heavily in a way that's affecting your life, you start to see these adverse consequences on your friends, on your family, and usually that starts to motivate people to make a change. But when there's regular cannabis use, one of the dangerous things about this drug is that it is hijacking the very system that might make you care that you're losing your friends, you're losing your family, you're not doing well in school. And so it makes it extremely hard to treat as well.
All right. And if you just tuned in, we're talking to Danielle Dick, director of Rutgers University's Addiction Research Center. If you have a question or comment, you want to talk about your concerns about teen use of cannabis, our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. I want to go to another caller who wants to talk about the potency issue. Josh is a cannabis professional. Josh, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to point out that, you know, highly concentrated forms of cannabis have been widely used for centuries. People have made hashish and all these other kinds of things. And I think that the potency argument is rather disingenuous for that reason, and because there's a problematic interest in the cannabis industry with representing products as being more potent than they are. And the reality of the potency that's reflected on labeling is often inaccurate, and they utilize a questionable methodology for arriving at those percentages just because they use it for marketing purposes.
That's fascinating. Danielle, can you respond to that? Is it possible that this stuff is not as potent as it claims to be? I mean, is there lab evidence that suggests weed truly is more potent now than it's been in the past?
Yes. I really appreciate your raising that issue. Labeling is a big problem. And so, you know, I really appreciate the callers raising this, that in fact, you know, often you can't tell exactly what the potency is because there is a mismatch between labeling and what the product actually is. And I think that's also a product of legalization happening faster than we really have a system set up to ensure those kinds of things. But the potencies that I'm talking about, we know are accurate because it's coming from marijuana that gets seized on the street through all the different ways that police come in contact with seizing marijuana. And then that gets sent to the lab for testing. And of course, they've done that for decades. And that's where those numbers showing an increased potency are coming from.
So we want to get to this conversation about how you have conversations with young people about cannabis in a world where they're going to pass dispensaries on the street, where it's going to be legal in their communities. We have a caller on line three, Anne, who has a teenage son and has some concerns. Anne, welcome to Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Hi, yes, thank you for having this incredibly important topic that you're discussing today. It's just so important because it's such a heartbreaking issue, a personal issue to myself and my family. I can hardly talk about it without crying, but if you want to see the results, I know the last caller has a great question, but my son started using marijuana at 14 and he was diagnosed with a hyperemesis syndrome, and it's just so easily accessible with the vapes and different things that they use. And it's just, parents just have to know. I think if I had anything to suggest, just really start educating them earlier about the dangers of marijuana. So many people try to tell me it's not a big deal. Well, 3 years of my son being addicted to marijuana and me doing everything I can to get him the proper help, his motivation is so affected. His memory is affected. It affects, just like the lady here today, your guest, when she was discussing the doesn't care attitude. They don't care about anything. It affects every part of their life.
Yeah.
And I just want to express for parents out there, it's real. And just get help. Ask your pediatrician, and they can put you in touch with people. But it's really heartbreaking what's happening. And just one other quick comment. I'm so sad, but when states legalized marijuana, they really left our kids out of the equation. And it makes me so sad and also angry.
Yeah.
So Anne, thank you so much for sharing that. And I know that was difficult. Danielle, could you respond a bit on how parents can start that conversation with a young person if they're worried about them developing a dependency?
Absolutely. And again, thank you to the caller for sharing your story. And, you're certainly not alone. I talk to many parents who are in the exact same boat with their kids. And so one of the things that we know, which is true of cannabis, but it's also true of other drugs as well, of alcohol, of opioids, is that parents do need to have honest conversations with their kids. Time and time again, kids say that's what they want. You know, fortunately, the scare tactics of my youth, the just say no or the egg in the frying pan that many of us will remember from the 80s, are mostly gone. And we know that what kids really want is accurate and honest information. Because to say, you know, if you use cannabis, horrible things are going to happen to you. Well, a kid can look around and say, well, I know lots of people who have tried. And the reality is that adolescents are in a period of experimentation. And so wanting to experiment and try some things is developmentally normative. And so if you try and say, you know, if you do it, a horrible thing is going to happen. Well, they look around and say, well, that doesn't match my experience. So what we need is for parents, as the caller was saying, to understand these realities that marijuana is far more potent today. It is, you know, associated with these really negative things like memory, you know, harmful effects on memory and motivation, and helping kids to think through how might that alter your life, or does that align with your priorities or your goals? And so talking to your kids honestly, finding ways to ask them questions as an entry point. So as opposed to, I want to tell you about marijuana and all of the dangerous things with it. Instead, one can start the conversation by saying, you know, hey, I heard on the radio today a scientist talking about marijuana and kids. Is this something that your friends are talking about? Or do you know people who are using or have tried it? You know, what are your thoughts on it? So having that dialogue with your kids, and then also being armed with the facts so you can provide them with those facts too.
Yeah. And Danielle, I want to sort of add a little bit of balance here, because we have a comment from Mike. He says, you are villainizing marijuana. It does not make people low energy. I am a creative person in a circle of creatives. It is not this terrible thing. It is great. I want you to respond to that and talk about the differences, I think, a little bit between a young developing mind and an adult, for example, and the difference between how marijuana could impact those groups based on their age.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate that comment. Mm-hmm. And I will say that even among researchers and academics, there is this active and vigorous conversation, because many individuals use cannabis, enjoy using it, use it recreationally in the same way that many individuals use alcohol recreationally. And that's a part of our society. But we also know that in the same way that alcohol is more dangerous for kids and has different effects on developing brains, that's certainly the case for cannabis as well. So I don't mean to come across as anti-cannabis or anti-legalization, but what I do have concerns about and want to make sure other parents are aware of is that in the same way that we would be concerned if our kids were, for example, drinking a liter of vodka, we might not be concerned if they have a beer with friends, if they're trying that, but we would probably be concerned if they drank a liter of vodka. The reality is that cannabis is far more potent, and it's very hard to understand dosage. Mm. And so oftentimes, the ways that kids are experimenting or using regularly is more analogous to the drinking a liter of vodka than having a beer. And so this is, and for a developing brain in particular, that's very concerning. And I'll often have parents ask me, well, you know, if I smoke sometimes or I drink, how do I tell my kids not to? And what I always say is, you know, the reality is that that's why we're parents and they're kids. And I drink socially, but I say to my teenage son, you know, hey, these are the rules as to why no alcohol is allowed in our house, and I feel strongly about your not using. And if you do, there'll be consequences, because the reality is that your brain is still growing and developing. My brain, this is as good as it's going to get. But alcohol will affect your brain differently. Mm. And that's exactly the same with cannabis as well.
All right. Well, more to talk about, perhaps for another day. Danielle Dick is the director of the Rutgers University Addiction Research Center. Danielle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, Studio 2 Trivia. We have Mike from Ardmore on the line, ready to answer today's question. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. She's Cherry Gregg.
And he is Avi Wolfman-Arendt. He is our game show host for today. And of course, this is Studio 2's Trivia Thursday. And today's contestant, Mike from Ardmore. Mike, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, hi, Cherry. All right, how you doing?
Good. You feeling lucky today, Mike?
Yeah, generally.
Are you a night owl or an early bird?
I guess it depends on the day. I go back and forth on those.
Okay, like a lot of us. He might have been up late, though, for Election Day, since we're all talking politics, so we'll see.
Yeah, so if you get this right, Mike, I should note that you could win a WHYY tote bag.
More like a grocery bag.
It's like a grocery tote bag. So that's what's grocery at tote. Stake. I'm going to read you a question with four answers, so it's multiple choice. So wait for all the choices, mm-hmm. and then walk us through your process and give the answer. Does that sound good, Mike?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
You sound ready. Okay.
So before running for Philadelphia mayor, newly minted Democratic nominee Sherelle Parker was a member of Philadelphia City Council. Listen carefully. Who was the last Philadelphia mayor who did not serve on City Council before becoming mayor? Is it A, Frank Rizzo, B, Michael Nutter, C, Ed Rendell, or D, John Street?
Process of elimination. You want
to? Yeah. I don't think it's. I think Ed Rendell wasn't on City Council, but I'm not sure if he was the last one.
Do you want to?
You're going to have to jump at some point here, Mike. What do you think?
Take a leap.
I think I'm like 75% convinced that that might be it, Ed Rendell.
Leaning in, push the button.
good to go with your gut. Your gut led you to the correct answer, Mike. It is indeed Ed Rendell.
Yes. Winner, winner, chicken dinner there. Rendell had been district attorney in Philadelphia, but never on city council. In fact, he never served in any legislative body during his long political career. So there you go.
Well done, Mike. That was impressive. I really like the fact that you weren't totally sure. Like that makes me, it gives me that genuine feel good for you, because it feels good to get one that you really know, but it feels even better to get one that you kind of know. Well done.
And Mike, you're gutsy, because you just said, you know what? You went with your gut. So go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you. And you guess what? You're going to be one of the first contestants to get our official Studio 2 grocery bags. And they're kind of, you know, they're kind of glitzy glam. So, you know, put your broccoli in there. And tell everybody, did you enjoy your Studio 2 trivia time?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I'll listen intently in the future, too.
All right.
That is the correct answer. That is the correct answer. So every Thursday, we do have a brand new question. You can participate if you want to be the next Studio 2 trivia contestant. Here's what you do. You do what Mike already did. Mm-hmm. Call 215-351-0525. Leave us a message. Tell us why you'd be a great player. Our producers will call you back if you are selected. And again, that number is 215-351-0525.
And it's about to be the weekend. WHYY's Tanya Pendleton has our things to do list.
Summer weekends, they just hit different. They expand your horizons as you traverse the city and burbs in search of a unique event, a favorite artist, or maybe, if you're lucky, a fateful meeting.
Summer loving happens so fast.
I met a girl crazy for me.
We can't promise you love, but we can recommend some places you might be able to find it. I know a lot of folks connect on dating apps, but rom-coms tell us love can still happen in a meet-cute, but only if you're there to find it. So let's start with festivals. Roxborough Spring Fest happens on Saturday. It's on Ridge Avenue from Lyceum to Leverington, featuring everything from live performances to plein air painting. It starts at noon. If you're looking for a creative bay, head to the Fairmont Art Scrawl on Sunday. You'll see more than 40 exhibits from local artists, and it also kicks off at noon. If you like food, then you may find a fellow foodie at the South 9th Street Italian Festival. This year, the two-day fest starting on Saturday honors Jerry Blavitt, the geeter with the heater, who entertained Philadelphians for 6 decades before he died in January.
I learned how to dance by watching my mother. The Italians, whenever that radio was on, they would start to dance. And I watched my mother's steps, and I danced in Jitterbug with my mother.
Thanks for the memories, Jerry. The South 9th Street Italian Festival starts at 11 a.m. both days. There are even more festivals in and around Philly, and we'll have them on our website, whyy.org/things to do. The LGBTQ plus community is gathering for Pride Fest. They're celebrating through the weekend with opening and closing parties and a tribute to Elton John. One of the most anticipated events is the Pride Parade that goes from Lambertville, New Jersey to New Hope, Pennsylvania. And once they get to New Hope, the Pride Fair begins with food, community, and arts vendors and live performances from artists like dance icon Otra Nate. The parade starts at 11 a.m.
Daddy, we're eating your favorite meal today, chicken and biscuits.
If you've ever had a good combination of chicken and biscuits, you know it's both filling and tasty. That's what the creators and cast of the play Chicken and Biscuits hope you'll take away from their production at the Bristol Riverside Theater. Douglas Lyons wrote this comedy about what happens to two sisters when a family secret is revealed at their father's funeral. It goes through June 4th. Weekends, they're for the birds. We mean that literally. A new exhibit, Illuminating Birds, is opening Saturday at the Academy of Natural Sciences. The interactive exhibit focuses on drawings and books on birds. At the exhibit, you can even try your hand at creating avian art. Illuminating Birds is free with museum admission.
I can't stop chasing my dreams. Every night I lay my head down, but I can't sleep.
Indie record store Brewery Town Beats, in conjunction with Radio Kismet, is hosting a four-week series called Black Diamond Soul. Their first event takes place on Friday with New Jersey's own Black Butterfly, who you may know if you're familiar with local jazz collective Omar's Hat. She's at Radio Kismet on 34th and Sansom, and the show starts at 8. David Bowie and Prince, two of the most creative artists of their time. And in 2016, both transcended into a higher realm within months of each other. These phenomenal talents will be remembered at Ardmore Music Hall's The Music of Bowie and Prince on Sunday. Musicians from the bands Twiddle, Pink Talking Fish, Talk, and Cool 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 will perform. The show starts at 7:30. That sounds like our cue. We're going to ride on out of here on Beethoven's Ninth. You can hear it live at The Man tonight at 8 p.m. Yannick Nezet-Segan is conducting the Morgan State University Choir along with Dr. Eric Conway. It's part of the HBCU Festival at The Man, but it's the only part of it that still has tickets available. I'm Tanya Pendleton, and we'll be back next Thursday with another edition of Things to Do. We invite you to head to our website, whyy.org/things to do, for more info, including when you can find free activities for kids at Sister Cities Park and what's happening at Philly's Magic Gardens starting on Friday. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
Well, all right. Lots of cool things to do this weekend.
And I'm just hoping the rain holds up on Saturday, because I would love to go to that Italian Market Festival. Yeah. I usually check that out. It's right by my house, and it's a great time.
I used to live over there. It was a great time. Well, that is it for us on a Thursday. For more of our show, you can head on over to whyy.org/studio2. You can also follow WHYY on Twitter. We, of course, use the hashtag Studio2.
Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Al Banks. WHYY's audio general manager is Joan Isabella from Studio 2. At WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I am Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful weekend.